welcome to this Tuesday, New Year's Eve edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A little bit later today, we'll visit with Matt Olien, and he'll review the movie Nosferatu, a movie that's been called the darkest movie of the year by The Atlantic. And my colleague Tate Calloway explores practical tools for managing stress and anxiety with experts in mindfulness and sound healing. He'll discover how slowing down, embracing sound as a grounding tool, and retraining the mind can help create a calmer, more centered life. And I'll air my interview with Scott Hopkins. He's the executive director of Feed My Sheep, and he joined me to discuss how his organization provides nutritious food to those in need in Lahaina, Maui, Hawaii, and how it has adapted to support the community in need in the aftermath of devastating fires. But first today, we welcome North Dakota State University head football coach Tim Polasek to Main Street ahead of the FCS National Championship game, which will be played next Monday night. The Bison will take on the Montana State University Bobcats in Frisco, Texas, and we wanted to catch up with Coach Polasek before his team departed to Frisco, Texas. Coach Tim Polasek was named the head football coach at North Dakota State University 1 year ago, and he came back to Fargo from Iowa, where he coached from 2017 to 2020, and from the University of Wyoming in Laramie from 2021 to 2023. First, Coach, congratulations on guiding your team this year to the upcoming national championship football game.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, we just got done with a little bit of a Zoom with some national media, local media, and it's interesting. I haven't given much thought to myself. You know, it's all about providing opportunities for these young people to reach their full potential, and we have a chance to go win number 10.
Yeah, Coach, this game's never been played on a Monday night. And in your eyes, how do you compare football, I guess, in the FCS today versus what you spent a lot of time at recently in the FBS?
Well, the last two, 3 weeks, there's not a whole lot of difference. Good ball is good ball. You know, I'm so impressed with, you know, the four teams that made it to the semifinals, it's crystal clear, right? Like, everything starts up front. You know, big, strong, athletic guys that are willing to work together, you know, do their role for the betterment of the team, be serviceable for the linebackers if you're the D-line, be serviceable if you're an O-lineman, to provide opportunities for the quarterback and the backs and the receivers and the tight ends. And so I don't see a whole lot of different. The development of offense and defense alignment at the Missouri Valley Conference is at a high level. You know, it's most certainly at that, you know, group of five level for sure. I think once you climb into the Big Ten, you know, obviously you're talking about the kids are developed faster. You know, as sophomores, you can look at these guys and evaluate them, where a lot of our recruits, you know, you really want to see them in the summer going into their senior year. And so that's the biggest difference, is just the maturity level at a young age.
Coach, another thing I've wondered about this season is whether it might actually be more enjoyable to coach in the FCS versus all of the NIL pressures, et cetera, that are happening in the league above. Not that they're not happening in the FCS either, but do you still get to be more of a coach than you might have had you stayed in the FBS?
Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's a really good question. It's a great question. The one thing I can tell you, you know, at Wyoming, we had some movement, right, with the portal. And, you know, it was mostly guys going back home or getting closer to home, you know, whether that was L.A. or Texas, or guys that were from further distances away. But, you know, we never had a kid come in and say, hey, you know, Coach Bull, you're being too hard on me, or Coach Polasek coaches too aggressively. You know, most of the time it was family and distance circumstances. And then oftentimes it does boil down to a dollar amount, right? And the amount of opportunity from a money standpoint that's out there is really crazy, but I'm not sure it's always the best football opportunity. And so right now what we're focused on here is giving these kids a chance to be part of a program. You know, we're not building a team from year to year. We're running a program. We're building a program. The program has been obviously very successful going back to the 60s. And that's the kind of stuff that we embrace. I think that's the best counterpunch to the portal and to the NIL, is to create and cultivate an environment where kids grow, kids can get better, they have a good time. It's important to have fun. Let's not forget about that. It's not about rushing into adulthood and making money all the time.
Coach, when Craig Bull first came to the University of Wyoming, I asked him this question, and I'm going to ask you the same question too. If he could only have one Would he rather have the bronze boot or a Mountain West Conference championship? Now, coach, you only get one. You only get the Dakota Marker or a Missouri Valley Conference championship. What are you picking?
Missouri Valley Football Conference championship right now, because you'd have both. You know, most of the time you're going to get both. No, a conference championship leads to the Missouri Valley Conference Football Championship is this important. It's home field advantage. It's home field advantage throughout the playoffs. And that was one of our goals. You know, get home field advantage. Let's lead the country in physicality, and let's do everything in our power to eliminate distractions daily from being our best.
Coach, do you view yourself as the CEO of the Bison? And then what's your role on game day? How do you perceive your role when it's time to play?
You know, I don't have all the answers yet, obviously, but it's our job to have answers and to become experts in our fields. The one thing I like to take pride in is the mindset of the football team, you know, still being the leader of the mindset and the direction for the week, right? I've really enjoyed laying out all the schedules and the plan, you know, so that performance is peaking at the end of the season. My role on game day, right, is to lead the guys out, to show them a great deal of confidence, and then obviously spread, you know, a little bit of wisdom right before we go out of the locker room to clarity of what it's going to take to win. And then I think nowadays clock management and game management is so important. You know, they've added the 2-minute warning in college, and that's really added a lot of nuance to the college game. It's sometimes hard to find from the naked eye, but there's been a lot of situations that have come up this year where you can get a 2-for-1. You can position yourself to win the middle eight, you know, the middle 8 minutes of before half and then coming out of the locker room in the third quarter. And so I think that's a big deal for the head coach. But honestly, it kind of comes down to providing, and I'm not a very calm person. I'm pretty exciting and excitable and enthusiastic. But I think you got to pour confidence into the coordinators and not at one particular place or with a particular head coach. But that is so critical that you allow the coordinators to trust their preparation and their plan and to be aggressive throughout.
How important was the CU game for you setting the tone for this year for your team, coach?
Well, I do think it was critical. And another great question, like, why was it critical? It really didn't mean anything if you look at it, right? Like, big picture, it doesn't mean a whole lot. But I think for our guys to go out there and, okay, whatever the nuance is, are we going to embrace it? Are we still going to perform well? You know, we basically ran out of time against Colorado. And if, you know, a call or two goes our way, you know, we probably win that game. And it was interesting. I think we've cultivated a lot of confidence. We also were able to pinpoint areas that we're going to have to improve in order to be competitive. And so all those things were very positive. And then going into a big time environment on national TV for our kids is always a lot of fun.
You look back on the season, coach, was there a time when you thought, I'm not sure, or the converse? Yep, we're on our way. Was there a moment you can share with us?
Yeah, there's, you know, one of each. I think the East Tennessee State game, you know, just on defense, right? It was just a little bit like, okay, if we don't box people up and we want our defenders to constantly be playing in space to tackle and to cover, you know, that's hard on anybody. And so I think Grant Olson, in a short time, showed such unbelievable growth and leadership skills, and how he was going to attack the process the rest of the year was instrumental to us probably getting to that moment of, you know, beating South Dakota State and UND. I called it rivalry roll, right? When we won those couple games, I was like, okay, the Missouri Valley's good. We're playing really good defense right now, and our quarterback's hot. If we can continue to get better every day, you know, improve, value our opportunities to practice and to be with each other, we can captivate and reach our full potential. And I think we're on the verge of doing that.
Coach, you've been coaching since 2003 when you were at Wisconsin's Stevens Point. When did you decide in your mind that this is my career?
Oh, good. Actually, I started coaching in 2002 because I would count the year of high school, you know, when I was a student teacher. Now, somewhere in my boxes, and you get lose track of your boxes. But when I was about 15 or 16, I wrote an essay that I wanted to coach high school basketball and football. I took a football 101 class with my college coach, who means a lot to me. We had to write down like our philosophy and what we would do offensively and defensively in this football 101 class, you know, for my teaching degree of physical education. And I put down improve consistently with a foxhole mentality, protect the team and what the program stands for, or something to that effect. And at that moment, once I got into college football playing quarterback, I shifted gears and I said, you know, I really want to chase college football, and I would chase my aspirations down until I'm 30, and then I would adjust if I had to go back and teach and be a high school coach. So pretty early on, I knew I wanted to be in a leadership role and I wanted to teach and coach, but it wasn't probably until I started playing that college football was the answer for me.
Are people surprised to learn that you were a gunslinging, throwing quarterback coach?
Yeah, Coach Bull, that was the one thing that he used to like to pick and nag at me at, because I look more like a linebacker or a fullback or something. You know, only being about 5'10", 235 pounds. And, not once they see me throw the ball still at practice, then they're like, okay, I get it. I was a Division III quarterback. I got a great opportunity. It really laid a foundation down for me. I think the Division III experience for me, not only as a coach at UW-Stevens Point, but as a player, I hope it keeps me humble and it keeps me grounded. Those coaches do so much for those players for very little. And they coach for the pure passion and joy to compete and to help others. And that's really impacted my teaching model or my teaching style. I have a great deal of admiration for not only Division III coaches, but Division III players, right? They're just playing for the pure joy and love of the game.
Coach, what's your schedule? When do you take off for Frisco?
So we're on practice 5 right now. Be a pretty physical practice. We're going to take the guys over to Sweet Shots and Kingpins for a little New Year's Eve kind of gift. And then we'll have the evening off and we'll come back the next day at 10. But we basically will practice on Friday morning, and we're going to practice in pads. And we're gonna hit and fit our pads a little bit Friday morning. And then we'll begin to pack our stuff. And we leave at 2:30 for a nice evening of no football. And then Saturday and Sunday will be jam-packed with football activities.
Who's the best golfer on your team, Coach?
Oh, on the team. The kickers, you know, I've gotten to know the specialist pretty well. All of those guys like to play. I'm carrying about a 6.5, and that's after playing
nice.
Full FCC. So I would say one of the kickers, but I haven't been able to play with them yet. And we have a couple coaches that swing it pretty good. I would have to put myself in the conversation. I just don't know how many putts I would make on that day.
Before I let you go, Coach, you're an underdog, and I'll say again, what's that mean to you?
I love it. Can't wait. I'd like to say period. But no, that's kind of like, that's been my approach. And if you look at my story or our story as a staff, you know, there's D3 guys on the staff. There's Division I guys on the staff. I wouldn't want it any other way. And then quite frankly, we don't look at it that much. But what I've encouraged the guys all year is let's get that big chip back on our shoulder. When we were a bunch of guys trying to prove something to the world, you know, the way Coach Bowl built it, the way that Chris Kleiman carried it through, probably how Matt was, you know, initially, and how Matt continued to try to be. But we needed to put a big chip back on our shoulder. And we have to play every week like we have something to prove, and we have to live up to the standards that the former Bison players have set for us.
Coach Tim Polasek, he'll lead the Bison, the North Dakota State University Bison, against the Montana State University Bobcats in the FCS National Championship football game Monday night at 6 p.m. That's when kickoff is, and it'll be broadcast nationally on ESPN. Coach, best wishes and congratulations.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you guys, and I wish the best to Bison Nation. Thank you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, broker and realtor with Real Broker LLC. With a team of agents serving homebuyers, sellers, and investors throughout North Dakota, the Detroit Lakes area, and Northwest Minnesota. Josh can be reached at 701-367-3513.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We all face stress and anxiety every day. Prairie Public's Tay Calloway speaks with two experts on how to manage these emotions.
Most days start off like this. That's a bit dramatic for some of us. Most days probably sound more like this. Most of us start our day off in a rushed and anxious state. Even if we don't get out of bed immediately, we can feel the weight of the world on our chest, and more so, our palm, through our phone, scrolling.
All right, we begin this hour with a massive Russian strike over Ukraine targeting the country's energy facilities. President,
remember when we thought that Pete Hegseth was the worst possible choice for a cabinet position? It will always get worse.
More scrolling. This person online looks like she's happy. Nice house, nice car, attractive partner. Maybe it's the ever-growing to-do list. Work piling up and deadlines creeping closer. Maybe it's the responsibility of children to care for, relationships to maintain, family members to check on. Whatever it is, the demands of life start the moment you wake up. And for most of us, anxiety is a default setting.
Surprise!
Even when we turn off the alarm, there's still a lingering buzz in the back of our minds telling us that we're late, or we're a bad mother or father, a bad friend or partner, shoot, that we're a failure. Slowly, it's spiraling and spinning us into confusion and chaos.
If you think of a merry-go-round and a lot of children running around the outside to speed it up really fast and they jump on, when you are on that merry-go-round and it's spinning really fast, you can't see the kids on the outside going, let me on, let me on. My name is Sari Jans, and my business is Inner Spark Coaching and Hypnosis. So if you think of those kids on the outside of that merry-go-round as solutions to your problems, deeper based thinking, all of the things that you're trying to access when you're in a stressed or overwhelmed state, you can't. So it's very important to be able to slow down the merry-go-round of the mind so you can see those solutions so they can jump on.
We spend so much time just going through the motions of the day, just getting through the day, let alone experiencing our day or processing what we experience. And there are many tools that we have. There's all kinds of different tools that we can use to get us into this place where we can slow down, open up, and process. I'm Jennifer Olson, the owner and sound healing practitioner at Resonance Sound Healing.
Meditation and mindfulness are beautiful because what it does is it brings us into an open awareness space where we can see ourselves from more of an observer standpoint rather than emotionally triggered standpoint. And so, interestingly enough, when we are in an anxiety or highly overwhelmed state, we're actually only accessing a small portion of our mind, and it's actually coined the fight or flight part of our brain. And so when we're stressed, we cannot even access the outer lobes of the brain. The blood doesn't flow there.
Imagine yourself in a boxing ring, ready for the big fight. The bell rings, you stand up, and across from you is you. Not only do we have to deal with things from the outside world, we also have to combat the ideas and feelings we hold on to.
And so meditation and mindfulness help us calm the mind, get back into our body, and allow that blood to flow back into the outer lobes of the brain. This mind is a muscle, so just like we go into a personal training session, we don't expect six-pack abs in the first session. The same thing with our mind. So we can retrain the mind to work as a tool for our favor rather than working against us.
We have to develop new habits to help retrain our minds. In order to do that, we need to find out what helps us feel more like ourselves and what helps ground us.
So for me, that is sound. Sound is a beautiful tool that when we listen, our brain will actually, if you measure the brainwave frequencies, they're gonna slow down and we get into more receptive states where we can more easily, more intuitively, less on purpose and with our thinking brain, begin to recognize what's happening in our lives and in our bodies and in our minds. And then recognizing that and being able to process it and move through it. That happens much more easily and much more naturally when we can slow ourselves down to allow it. Sound is beyond words. I don't have words, I have sounds. And sounds are universal. We all hear them. We all experience them differently. It's coming down to using sound as a tool to slow down, to open up, to create space for being able to recognize what's going on in your life the negatives, the positives, all of the things happening.
I have a little experiment for you to try and help manage anxiety and stress. Feel free to make changes and to find a tool that best works for you, but for this one, it's called Follow the Sound. Let's say you're at home and you're starting your morning and you want to start from a calm place. I want you to think of some sounds that connect with you. If you don't like ambient music, it could be lo-fi, rap, classical, soul, shoot, it could be anything. It could be someone from home. Like for me, it's the voices of my family.
Hey, son. Hello. How are you? I called you yesterday. I called you and I left you a voicemail. You met your girlfriend yet?
It's a rude interviewer. Anybody, if you listen to this recording, you can hear that Mr. Calloway is a rude interviewer.
That my favorite ice cream is cookie cream.
But dancing, marching on my underwear, stop my jacket, I would all go marching down to the ground.
These things always calm me down. It's all about finding what works for you. For some, it may be music or ASMR sounds like rain in the ocean or popping. Maybe it's the sound of your child or spouse or a grandparent or writing, painting, fishing. It's up to you to discover. And we know mindfulness and meditation may not be for everyone. And that's okay. If the idea of sitting still or focusing on your breath doesn't resonate with you, consider approaching it as a way to reduce stress and manage anxiety.
The hard things that come our way are so much easier to handle when we know we have a calmness in our center that we can address it from.
Slow down. Take some time for yourself and find ways to reduce your stress. And if I'm the problem right now, then turn the radio down. But it's kind of a little too late. From Prairie Public, I'm Tay Calloway.
Coming after the break, Madeline reviews the movie Nosferatu, called one of the darkest movies of the year. And I'll air my conversation with Scott Hopkins of Feed My Sheep. It's an organization in Maui, Hawaii, that provides nutritious food to those in need in Lahaina, and we'll learn how his group has adapted to support the community in the aftermath of devastating fires. That's after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, serving 3 million consumers in 9 states with electricity from wind, natural gas, coal, and hydro.
There's the fanfare. Madeline joins us in the Main Street studio. Matt, this is the last time we're going to hear that, at least for this year.
That's right.
Happy New Year, Matt. Welcome back to Main Street.
Yeah, it's been a great year for movies, I feel, just like 2023 was.
And we'll look forward to some more great movies for sure in 2025. You're ending the year with a movie that opened on Christmas Day, although, Matt, this isn't your grandparents' Christmas movie at all. This is, in fact, The Atlantic called Nosferatu the darkest movie of the year. Here's the trailer.
Come to me. Come to me. I've never shared my secret with any soul.
You've had these spells since childhood. Tell me what you can from the beginning.
It is like a dream. It was our wedding. When we turned around, everyone was dead. The stench of their bodies was horrible. Standing before me was never been so happy.
This creature is a force more powerful than evil. Its desire
is to consume all life on Earth.
Only you can redeem us.
In this world, and I have met him.
But you could never please me as he could.
All right, Matt, we've heard the trailer. Robert Eggers' 2024 film, remaking the gothic horror tale that was first, I guess, released in 1922, Matt, over 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
How did it work for you?
So this is, yeah, this is a direct remake, although longer than the silent 1922 film Nosferatu, which was directed by F.W. Murnau. And for those who know, it featured the terrifying Count, played by Max Schreck, who looks like no other Dracula character we've ever seen. Long fingernails, horrifically, you know, the makeup is crazy. It's just, he's the scariest Count, I think, by far. And so Eggers tries to replicate that with Bill Skarsgård playing Count Orlok in this movie. So it's really a remake of Nosferatu, not necessarily of the book, the Bram Stoker book, Dracula, although Stoker is credited in the credits as, you know, a lot of stuff is taken from that. I agree. It's one of the darkest movies of the year. Eggers, you know, such an interesting filmmaker. The Witch, The Lighthouse, The Northman. And again, just like those films, it has a crazy visual style, kind of an over-the-top visual style. The cinematography by Yaron Blaschke, I think, should get an Oscar nomination. It's really evocative of the Gothic period. It takes place 1838 Germany. So with this version, they move the setting from London to Germany. Of course, you know, in the Francis Coppola version from 1992 of Dracula, he relocates to London via The Voyage of the Demeter, which actually was a movie last year, The Last Voyage of the Demeter. So once again, we are seeing the decades-old box office juggernaut that is Count Dracula. And even though he's Count Orlok in this, and Dracula, Craig, is the most portrayed fictional character in the history of on-screen cinema because of all the remakes, and they just can't kill him, right? He comes back in another movie. So the visuals are really drive this movie. Bill Skarsgård under extremely heavy makeup, including a mustache on Dracula, which I wasn't wild about. His voice is very low, almost feels like they recorded it in a closet. I wasn't completely wild about that either. But the heart of this movie is Lily Rose Depp as Ellen Hutter. So she is Johnny Depp's daughter. She gives a great performance. She's the one that Count Orlok wants. He wants to be with her. He wants her to be his bride. And it's this weird flashback to her childhood when she felt like she was haunted by some demon. And of course, it's Count Orlok who's waiting, wants her to be his vampire bride. Her husband, Thomas Hutter, is played by Nicholas Holt. And just like in the original book, Craig, he is sent to the Carpathian Mountains to sell property to Count Orlok. We know usually in the book, it's Jonathan Harker was his name. He gets sent there by his employer, under the guise of, you know, we got to sell this Count, this property, this awful, you know, ruins in Germany. But really, of course, his employer is controlled by Dracula. He wants, or Count, I keep calling him Dracula, but he's Count Orlok in the movie. He wants him back in Germany because he is subservient to the Count. So that's the journey. There's the Voyage of the Demeter. You know, Count Orlok ends up in Germany and, you know, all hell breaks loose, so to speak. And, of course, they have to kill him, right? So as in all Draculas, who do they call in, Craig? Professor Van Helsing, who in this case is Professor Elben Eberhard von Franz, played of course, by Willem Dafoe, who is one of the director's favorites and who just knows how to chew the scenery and is great when he shows up and tries to figure out how they're going to kill this horrible being. But I think the film works for the most part. It's creepy. It's artsy. It's visual. It's stylish. I thought the pacing got a little slow in the middle because we know the story, right, Craig? That's the thing. We've seen this story so much. So I, as a film reviewer, ask myself, what more can they say about Nosferatu and Dracula? And yet, despite that, I do think Robert Eggers pulls it off for the most part. It's a really good movie. But the revelation here is Lily Rose Depp. She's the heart of the movie. She's a bigger character than Nicholas Holt is as Thomas Hutter. There's some side characters as well. Defoe comes in later. Like I said, I would have preferred some different makeup on Count Orlok. I wasn't sure about the mustache. You know, Bill Skarsgård plays him, and it's kind of an actor-proof role, I would say. But it's not the matinee idol Dracula that we're used to from Christopher Lee, Frank Langella, and Bela Lugosi. So go see it. It's gory. It's really gory. And what an interesting box office twist with Christmas, Craig. This duo of Nosferatu and the Bob Dylan movie, A Complete Unknown, just dominated the box office at Christmas. People want to go see the Bob Dylan movie. It made over $20 million Christmas weekend, and Nosferatu makes $40 million. So these are not your typical Christmas movies, but they formed an unlikely duo at the box office.
Matt, before I let you go, you mentioned that the movie is kind of, it's maybe a little long, I think is what I heard you saying.
A little bit.
But the horror aspects of the story, does the attention to, I guess, artistic detail take at all away from the horror aspects of the story? And as you know, Matt, this isn't a genre that I enjoy, but others obviously really do.
I think the film is more artistic than scary, okay? I didn't think the tension in the movie was particularly tense. Now, that again is because this is the Dracula story. We know what's going to happen, right? He's either going to get driven with a stake or killed by sunlight. And again, keep in mind, this is a remake of the Nosferatu silent movie. So there's going to be aspects that don't line up with the Coppola Dracula or any of the Draculas that people maybe have seen. I think it's more artistic than scary. When the gore comes, it's gory. If you do not have an appetite for blood, as Dracula does, that's a little pun there, don't go see this movie. But horror fans have flocked to it. I was wondering if horror fans would not go because they're more used to the Saw movies and kind of these modern slasher movies with teenagers running around and doing Ouija boards and conjuring up the dead. It's an old fable. It's Dracula. The book was written over 100 years ago, but they went. So it's very artistic, I would say.
Does the sex in this movie detract at all from its, I guess, vision?
No, there is a sex scene in the movie that people are either going to find artistic or revolting. We'll leave it at that. So, you know, it's an interesting scene when it comes. Let me just put it out there that way.
All right, let's turn to the Oscar trivia portion of our program, Matt. You, of course, know about the movie Black Swan in 2010. It was a psychological horror film. It did not win Best Picture that year. Which movie did? And also, which actress then, for her performance in Black Swan, won an Oscar?
So Natalie Portman wins the Oscar in Black Swan for Best Actress, and The King's Speech, I think, should not have won Best Picture that year, but did. I think The Social Network was the better movie.
Toy Story was in there too, wasn't it?
It was. Toy Story 3, right, was in the Best Picture mix. Really good Best Actress year, by the way. She beat some heavy hitters in that Best Actress category that year.
We've been to the movies for the last time in 2024 with our great friend, Matt Olien. Matt, thanks for joining us again on Main Street.
You bet.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service, starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
Scott Hopkins traveled to Maui, Hawaii 17 years ago looking for a change in his life, and he came upon a church youth group that was helping feed folks less fortunate than he was. Now, 17 years later, he's the executive director of Feed My Sheep, and he joined me in Hawaii to discuss how his organization provides nutritious food to those in need in Lahaina, Maui, and how it has adapted to support the community in the aftermath of fires that devastated the island just over 1 year ago. Scott Hopkins, welcome to Main Street.
Hi, thank you.
The organization is called Feed My Sheep. Scott, why are you here in Lahaina?
Well, we are here today doing one of our four weekly distributions for Feed My Sheep. We provide food for people in need, and we primarily focus on nutritious food like produce. Our goal is to help people who are in poverty or who are at risk of poverty get access to nutritious foods so that they don't necessarily have to deal with some of the negative health outcomes that come from being in poverty. So we bring food every week to 4 locations, and we provide about 10 pounds of groceries per person for the different families in need.
We remember the fires that were here in Lahaina just over a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, and how did that impact what you do for the area?
Well, in reality, what that did is remove an entire community from our, an entire region from our community, an entire region of homes and an entire region of businesses. So a lot of the people who were here and trying to make it work on Hawaii, which is difficult, have been given an extra hurdle to overcome. We have seen not only about, 100 or so homes lost and many lives lost as a result of that, but we've also seen a huge decrease in the amount of infrastructure to support our main industry, which is tourism. So a lot of people are trying to figure out how to get by. And prior to the fires, everyone is working 2 or 3 jobs. There aren't that many available anymore, and so a lot of family incomes are struggling right now.
It's impacted probably the number of people you serve?
Yeah, we've gone up quite a bit. The actual Lahaina distribution here is relatively small compared to before the fire, but that's because a lot of the households got displaced. Before the fires, about 15% of the people who came to feed my sheep were of the Lahaina residents, and now that's 40% or more. But they're going to our other sites now because they've had to find new places to live. And that's also created a problem with, we already had a housing shortage beforehand, so now rents are getting a lot higher, and the ability to house the people who need to actually work and do these jobs around here has become very complicated.
I want to talk about you personally. Why are you here?
Well, I came here back in 2007, just kind of needing to get away from my first career as a graphic designer and wanting to do something a little bit out of the ordinary, intending to do some sort of social justice missions to help people, with my faith informing, serving people in need. And I really did expect that it was going to be somewhere else, but when I arrived here, I discovered Feed My Sheep and realized it was exactly what I'd prayed for the chance to do. So I just started off as a office worker under Feed My Sheep's founder, Joyce Kawakami. And over the last 17 years, I've acquired the different skills and understandings to be able to do the role of the executive director when she came time for her to retire.
How are you funded?
So we have a lot of support from, we have a little bit of support from our local government. We have quite a bit of support from individuals and businesses and churches on Maui. And then we have off-island support, people who come and visit and enjoy what they do, they contribute as well. So we do have also a lot of in-kind donations. About half of our budget, about $600,000 worth of food a year, is donated because we have a lot of resources that have items that they can't sell, like, say, for example, Costco. It's no longer good for their shelves. No one's going to buy it, but it's in great condition to give away. So we are able to take volunteer help to sort out the bad from the good, recycle the bad food into our agricultural industry, and then put the good food to use in distributions and to share with our other organizations. Our staff actually works at our headquarters, receiving the donations and going out and handling the logistics. The farmers and the grocery stores will actually notify us when they have a donation ready.
You are the first person most folks see who come for food. What do you hear from them?
Well, I hear a lot of thanks and a lot of appreciation. They're usually like coming to us apprehensive because typically food programs like this can feel embarrassing or even shameful. You're trying really hard to make things work. It's not that you're being lazy in any way, shape, or form, but it still doesn't work. And so you come to one of these and you're not sure how to feel. So one of our goals is to make sure as fast as possible we learn their name, we recognize them, we smile. We train our volunteers to be welcoming and kind and respectful to them. And one of our mottos is we don't have clients, we have friends, because we never want to have a superiority attitude towards people in need. That just doesn't help. And if we can provide a place where they feel like they're welcome and accepted and appreciated, then they do behave a lot more in line with like treating it as a gift, not as an entitlement. So because we created that environment over the course of the 25 years we've been in operation, we get chances to know people over the course of over a decade in some cases, and to pray for them, to offer a listening ear. We can offer resources, we can connect them with other agencies, all because we do want to treat them like they are our friends.
One thing that it seems to me is unique is you use volunteers, literally, who come to you from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
Not the same volunteers day in and day out.
Yeah. Well, that's been a thing that has changed a little bit since COVID and the fires. People are really concerned about Maui right now, and we appreciate that. I think over the decades, Maui has been a host to a lot of family memories. You know, winter breaks and honeymoons and family vacations. And when people have heard that this place they have a connection to was hurting and in need, they came out of the woodwork. We actually had to redesign our processes to actually make more room for volunteers, because we understand that what you want is a chance to give back when you've received so much. Like, our number one export is relaxation, right? People come here and they're rejuvenated for life, so they want to come back here and give a little bit of that life that they've been given. And so, yeah, we've changed whatever we could to make room for more volunteers to come, to get more involved. And our hope is that you also feel a little bit more part of the community as you do that, because there's always historically been a divide between the tourists and the locals, and that might be a bridge that we have needed to gap to a gap we've needed to bridge for a long time. So we have been appreciating the chance to plug people in that way.
Do you have all the resources that you need?
The thing is that there's a lot of food that we could access with a little bit more donations of funds. One of our goals is actually also to raise funds for a headquarters for our organization. Right now we're on a temporary month-to-month lease with a very generous donor who has no intention of kicking us out. But long-term, our goal is to have some land that we can bring our friends into and teach them how to farm. So there is, over the last half century, there's been a great success in getting people who grew up in the family of farmers out to get higher education and do other jobs, which is awesome, but that makes our local infrastructure for food a little bit fragile, more than it would have been before. So one of our dreams has been to bring in our friends who have been, you know, they're renting, they don't have like a firm connection to their aina, their land. And so if we can give them a chance to come to a location, get their hands in the dirt, reestablish that connection, and reestablish the generations of understanding that this community has about how to use this specific dirt and soil and land for the purpose of serving our community. So one of our goals is to raise funds to build a headquarters and fund a farming program to do that kind of education. But that requires land in some of the most expensive parts of the world. So that's where our next big project is going to be focused on, is how do we open that up, raise the funds to build a building in the midst of a time where construction is very, very tight, because we have to build hundreds of homes right now.
Rebuild
and build. And yeah, we probably were short a couple hundred homes before the fire. So we got a lot of work to do, but we think we can.
If you were to look back and tell yourself 17 years ago something, what would you tell yourself, knowing what you know now, with all of the great work that you've done, Scott?
When things feel hard, that actually isn't a sign that you're doing the wrong thing. That was one of the biggest lessons I've had to learn. It does feel like this is an uphill battle. We do the same thing every week, and it is a little bit of recurring, doing the same efforts to rebuild from the previous week. So it feels like sometimes with the amount of work that's involved, I wonder if I made the wrong choice. But the reality is that it's actually the sign that you're in the right place, right? It's not a sign that you've made a mistake. It's a sign that you actually took the right steps, and you're just doing something very few other people have managed to do before you.
Best wishes, Scott.
Thank you very much.
Scott Hopkins is with Feed My Sheep in Lahaina on the island of Maui in Hawaii. It's been a pleasure.
Aloha. Thank you.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Daybook for December 31st. A shocking scandal involving P.M. Madsen of New Rockford broke on this date in 1900. Madsen, the state's attorney of Eddy County, faced sensational charges. Attorney E.C. Green was in New Rockford to investigate allegations that Madsen had charged gamblers and blind piggers for protection. The charges were so serious that the state was considering initiating impeachment proceedings against him. The matter came to a head when Madsen was accused of entering the billiard room at the Davis Hotel on December 17th. There, he became intoxicated and belligerent, allegedly pushing bowls of clam chowder off the bar and onto the floor. The bartender responded by smashing a plate into Madsen's head. Madsen then left the hotel. The scandal quickly became the talk of the town. Madsen had just been reelected, with another 2 years left in office, unless impeachment proceedings were initiated. Speculation arose that false accusations were being made against Madsen because influential businessmen were involved in illegal activities. It was suggested that these businessmen wanted to stop Madsen from closing down gambling dens and blind pigs. Instead of stopping him, it seemed likely that Madsen's actions would lead to the shutdown of these illegal activities. Of particular interest was the prominence of the people said to be connected with the joints and whose names must, of necessity, appear when the matter is probed. Some of these prominent individuals reportedly regretted underestimating Madsen and were scrambling to prevent the case from going to court. The matter ended in 1903 when Madsen initiated a lawsuit against his primary accuser. Michael O'Connor decided it would be better to retract his claims. He wrote a letter to the Bismarck newspaper, formally retracting his accusations against Madsen. O'Connor admitted that the statements therein made, accusing Madsen of being a confederate of blind piggers, blacklegs, and gamblers, were wholly false and were written by me while aggravated and before I realized the danger of such false charges. Madsen withdrew his lawsuit against O'Connor, and the matter was finally put to rest. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Prairie Public is your radio and streaming home for international, national, and regional news, outstanding non-commercial programming, and classical and roots rock and jazz music. We've also got tons of on-demand listening at prairiepublic.org, including podcasts. Check out the wonderfully intergenerational Davy B's Hit Song Vault for some fun musical nostalgia.
Then came Walk Like an Egyptian.
Oh.
Which was a goofy romp.
The timely and provocative Philosophical Currents with Jack Russell Weinstein.
The drag shows that are out there are so much milder than primetime television and commercials. This has to be about something else.
Learn facts and maybe some tall tales about the land we're living in on natural North Dakota.
The extremely secretive jackalope is perhaps the most elusive animal in the western United States.
And there's a ton of flavor on Dakota diners.
Do you like spicy?
Believe it or not, despite the fact that I've got Norwegian in me.
Good night. This is absolutely delicious.
And that's just a smattering. Check out all our podcasts at prairiepublic.org or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
And that's a wrap for Main Street 2024. We are grateful that you've continued to spend time with us each and every Monday through Thursday here on Main Street. We wish you a wonderful Happy New Year, and we look forward to seeing you again right here on Main Street in 2025.